Yes, sir.
When can we expect a waiver and acknowledgement from your client?
I'm not sure.
Technically, I don't have jurisdiction over her until I receive them.
Yes, I understand. I'm sure they'll be here soon. Her mail service is very slow.
Josh smiled at his protege. You actually found her, showed her a copy of the will, explained the waiver and acknowledgement, and agreed to represent her?
Yes, sir, Nate said, but only because he had to.
Will you put that in an affidavit for the file?
That's a bit unusual, isn't it? Josh asked.
Maybe, but if we start discovery without her waiver and acknowledgement, I want some record in the file showing that she's been contacted and knows what we're doing.
Good idea, Judge, Josh said, as if the idea had been his to start with. Nate will sign it.
Nate nodded and took a large bite of his sandwich, hoping they would let him eat without being forced to tell more lies.
Was she close to Troy? Wycliffe asked.
Nate chewed as long as he could before answering.
We're off the record here, aren't we?
Of course, this is just gossip.
Yes, and gossip can win and lose lawsuits.
I don't think they were that close. She hadn't seen him in years.
How did she react when she read the will?
Wycliffe's tone was indeed gossipy and chatty, and Nate knew the judge wanted all the details.
She was surprised, to say the least, he said dryly.
I'll bet. Did she ask how much?
Eventually, yes. I think she was overwhelmed, as anyone would be.
Is she married?
No.
Josh realized the questions about Rachel could go on for a while, and the questions were dangerous. Wycliffe could not know, at least not at that point, that Rachel had no interest in the money. If he kept digging, and if Nate kept telling the truth, something would slip.
You know, Judge, he said, gently steering the conversation in another direction, this is not a complicated case. Discovery shouldn't take forever. They're anxious, we're anxious, there's a pile of money sitting on the table, and everybody wants it. Why can't we fast-track discovery and set a trial date?
Speeding litigation along in a probate matter was unheard of. Estate lawyers were paid by the hour. Why hurry?
That's interesting, Wycliffe said.
What do you have in mind?
Have a discovery conference as soon as possible. Get all the lawyers in one room, make each produce a list of potential trial witnesses and documents, designate 30 days for all depositions, and set a trial date 90 days away.
That's awfully fast.
We do it in federal court all the time. It works. The boys on the other side will jump at it because their clients are all broke.
What about you, Mr. O'Reilly? Is your client anxious to get the money?
Wouldn't you be anxious, Judge? Nate asked.
And they all laughed. When Grit finally penetrated Hark's line of phone defenses, his first words were, "I'm thinking about going to the judge."
Hark pressed the record button on his phone and said, "Good afternoon to you, Grit.
I might tell the judge the truth, that Sneed has sold his testimony for $5 million and nothing he says is the truth."
Hark laughed just loud enough for Grit to hear.
"You can't do that, Grit."
"Of course I can."
"You're not very bright, are you? Listen to me, Grit, and listen good. First, you signed the note, along with the rest of us, so you're implicated in any wrongdoing you allege. Second, and most important, you know about Sneed because you were involved in the case as an attorney for Mary Ross. That's a confidential relationship. If you divulge any information learned as her attorney, then you breach the confidentiality. If you do something stupid, she will file a complaint with the bar, and I'll hound your ass into disbarment. I'll take your license, Grit. Do you understand that?"
"You're scum, Geddes. You stole my client."
"If your client was happy, then why was she looking for another lawyer?"
"I'm not finished with you.
Don't do anything stupid."
Grit slammed the phone down. Hark enjoyed the moment, then went back to work. Nate drove alone into the city, over the Potomac River, past the Lincoln Memorial, moving with the traffic, in no hurry. Flurries hit his windshield, but the heavier snow had not materialized. At a red light on Pennsylvania, he looked in his rear-view mirror and saw the building clustered among a dozen others where he had spent most of the past 23 years. His office window was 6 floors up. He could barely see it. On M Street, into Georgetown, he began to see the hangouts, the old bars and joints where he'd passed long, dark hours with people he couldn't remember anymore. He could, however, remember the names of the bartenders. Every pub had a story. In the drinking days, a hard day at the office or in the courtroom had to be softened with a few hours of alcohol. He couldn't go home without it. He turned north on Wisconsin and saw a bar where he'd once fought a college boy, a kid drunker than himself. A sleazy co-ed had prompted the dispute. The bartender sent them outside for the fisticuffs. Nate had worn a Band-Aid into court the next morning. And there was a small cafe where he'd bought enough cocaine to almost kill himself. The narcs raided it when he was in recovery. 2 stockbroker buddies went to jail. He'd spent his glory days on those streets while his wives were waiting and his kids were growing up without him. He was ashamed of the misery he'd caused. As he left Georgetown, he vowed never to return. At the Stafford home, he loaded his car again with more clothes and personal items, then left in a hurry. In his pocket was a check for $10,000, the first month's retainer. The IRS wanted $60,000 in back taxes. The fine would be at least that much, too. He owed his second wife about $30,000 in past due child support, monthly obligations racked up while he recovered with Sergio. His bankruptcy did not discharge these debts. He conceded that his financial future was indeed bleak. The younger children cost him $3,000 a month each in support. The 2 older ones were almost as expensive with tuition and room and board. He could live off the Phelan money for a few months, but the way Josh and Wycliffe were talking, the trial would be held sooner rather than later. When the estate was finally closed, Nate would go before a federal judge, plead guilty to tax evasion, and surrender his license. Father Phil was teaching him not to worry about the future. God would take care of his own. Once again, Nate wondered if God was getting more than he bargained for. Since he was incapable of writing on anything but a legal pad, with its wide lines and broad margins, Nate took one and tried to begin a letter to Rachel. He had the address of World Tribes in Houston. He would mark the envelope personal and confidential, address it to Rachel Lane, and attach an explanatory note. To whom it may concern. Someone at World Tribes knew who and where she was. Perhaps someone knew Troy was her father. Maybe this someone put 2 and 2 together and now knew that their Rachel was the beneficiary. Nate was also assuming Rachel would contact World Tribes if she had not already done so. She'd been in Corumbá when she'd come to the hospital. It was reasonable to believe she'd called Houston and told someone about his visit. She had mentioned her annual budget with World Tribes. There had to be a method of corresponding by mail. If his letter got in the right hands in Houston, then maybe it would find the right place in Corumbá. He wrote the date, then, "Dear Rachel." An hour passed while he watched the fire and tried to think of words that would sound intelligent. Finally, he opened the letter with a paragraph about snow. Did she miss it from her childhood? What was it like in Montana? There was a foot on the ground outside his window. He was compelled to confess that he was acting as her lawyer, and once he fell into the rhythm of legalese, the letter took off. He explained as simply as he could what was happening with the lawsuit. He told her about Father Phil and the church and its basement. He was studying the Bible and enjoying it. He was praying for her. When he finished, the letter was 3 pages long, and Nate was quite proud of himself. He reread it twice and declared it to be worthy of sending. If it somehow made it to her hut, he knew that she would read it again and again, and give not the slightest thought to any shortcomings in style. Nate longed to see her again. Chapter 42. One reason for the sluggish progress of the church's basement was Father Phil's penchant for sleeping late. Laura said she left home each weekday morning at 8 for kindergarten, and more often than not, the rector was still buried under the blankets. He was a night owl, he said, in self-defense, and he loved to watch old black-and-white movies after midnight. So when he called at 7:30 Friday morning, Nate was somewhat surprised. "Have you seen the Post?" he asked. "I don't read newspapers," Nate replied. He had broken the habit during rehab. Phil, on the other hand, read 5 a day. They were a good source of material for his sermons. "Perhaps you should," he said. "Why?" "There's a story about you." Nate put on his boots and trudged 2 blocks to a coffee shop on Main Street. There was a nice story on the front page of Metro about the finding of the lost heir of Troy Phelan. Papers had been filed late the day before in the Circuit Court of Fairfax County, in which she, acting through her attorney, a Mr. Nate O'Reilly, disputed the allegations of those contesting her late father's will. Since there wasn't much to say about her, the story dwelt on her attorney. According to his affidavit, also filed in court, he had tracked down Rachel Lane, showed her a copy of the handwritten will, discussed the various legal issues with her, and had somehow managed to become her lawyer. There was no indication of exactly where Ms. Lane was. Mr. O'Reilly was a former partner in the Stafford law firm, had once been a prominent trial lawyer, had left the firm in August, filed for bankruptcy in October, been indicted in November, and a final disposition of his tax evasion charges was still pending. The IRS claimed he beat them out of $60,000. For good measure, the reporter mentioned the useless fact that he had been divorced twice. To complete the humiliation, a bad photo ran with the story, one of Nate with a drink in his hand at a D.C. bar function several years earlier. He studied the grainy image of himself, eyes glowing, cheeks darkened with alcohol, goofy smile as if he were mixing and mingling with people he enjoyed. It was embarrassing. But it was another life. Of course, no story could be complete without a quick recital of the messy statistics of Troy's life and death, 3 wives, 7 known children, 11 billion or so in assets, his last flight from 14 floors up. Mr. O'Reilly could not be found for comment. Mr. Stafford had nothing to say. The lawyers for the Phelan heirs had evidently said so much already that they were not asked to comment again. Nate folded the paper and returned to the cottage. It was 8:30. He had an hour and a half before construction commenced in the basement. The bloodhounds now knew his name, but finding his scent would be difficult. Josh had arranged for his mail to be routed to a post office box in D.C. He had a new office phone number, one for Nathan F. O'Reilly, attorney at law. The calls were answered by a secretary in Josh's office who filed away the messages. In St. Michael's, only the rector and his wife knew who he was. Rumor had it that he was a wealthy lawyer from Baltimore writing a book. Hiding was addictive. Maybe that was why Rachel did it. Copies of Rachel Lane's response were mailed to all the Phelan lawyers, who, as a group, were electrified by the news. She was indeed alive and willing to fight, though her choice of lawyer was somewhat puzzling. O'Reilly's reputation was accurate, an efficient litigator with flashes of brilliance who couldn't handle the pressure. But the Phelan lawyers, along with Judge Wycliffe, suspected Josh Stafford was calling the shots. He'd rescued O'Reilly from rehab, cleaned him up, put the file in his hands, and pointed him toward the courthouse. The Phelan lawyers met Friday morning at Ms. Langhorne's place, a modern building packed among many on Pennsylvania Avenue in the business district. Her firm was a wannabe. With 40 lawyers, it wasn't big enough to attract blue-chip clients, but the leadership was very ambitious. The furnishings were showy and pretentious, the trappings of a bunch of lawyers desperate for the big time. They had decided to meet once a week, each Friday at 8, for no more than 2 hours, to discuss the Phelan litigation and plot strategy. The idea had been Langhorne's. She had realized that she would have to be the peacemaker. The boys were too busy strutting and fighting. And there was too much money to be lost in a trial where the contestants, all on one side of the room, were knifing each other in the back. It appeared, at least to her, that the raiding was over. Her clients, Gina and Cody, were sticking. Yancey seemed to have Ramble adequately collared. Wally Bright was practically living with Libigail and Spike. Hark had the other three, Troy Jr., Rex, and Mary Ross, and seemed content with his harvest. The dust was settling around the heirs. Relationships were becoming familiar. The issues had been defined. The lawyers knew they had better work as a team or lose the case. Number one was Sneed. They had spent hours watching the videos of his first effort, and each had prepared lengthy notes of ways to improve his performance. The fabricating was shameless. Yancey, in years past an aspiring screenwriter, had actually written a 50-page script for Sneed, filled with enough bald allegations to make poor Troy appear thoroughly brainless. Number two was Nicolette, the secretary. They would hammer her in a few days on video, and there were certain things she needed to say. Bright had the idea that perhaps the old man had had a stroke during sex with her, just hours before he faced the three psychiatrists, and this was something both Nicolette and Sneed could testify to. A stroke would mean diminished mental capacity. It was a decent idea, generally well received, and it prompted a lengthy discussion about the autopsy. They had not yet seen a copy of it. Poor guy was splattered on the bricks with terrible trauma to his head, as one would expect. Could the autopsy reveal a stroke? Number three was their own experts. Grit Shrink had made a hasty exit with the attorney, so they were down to four, one per firm. Four was not an unmanageable number at trial. In fact, four could be persuasive, especially if they all reached the same conclusions but by different routes. They agreed that they should also rehearse the testimony of their psychiatrists, grilling them and trying to make them crack under pressure. Number four was other witnesses. They had to find others who were around the old man in his last days. Sneed could help them there. The last item of business was the appearance of Rachel Lane and her lawyer. "There is nothing in the file signed by this woman," Hark said. "She's a recluse. No one knows where she is except for her lawyer, and he's not telling. It took a month to find her. She has signed nothing. Technically, the court does not have jurisdiction. It's obvious to me that this woman is reluctant to come forward." "So are some lottery winners," Bright inserted. "They want to keep it quiet, otherwise every bum in the neighborhood's beating on the door." "What if she doesn't want the money?" Hark asked, and the room was stunned. "That's crazy," Bright said on instinct, his words trailing away as he considered the impossible. While they were scratching their heads, Hark pushed forward. "It's just a thought, but one we should consider. Under Virginia law, a bequest in a will can be renounced. The gift remains in the estate, subject to the remainder provisions. If this will is struck down, and if there are no other wills, then the seven children of Troy Phelan take all. Since Rachel Lane wants nothing, then our clients divide the estate." Dizzying calculations raced through their heads. $11 billion less estate taxes divided by six. Then apply the appropriate percentages, and serious wealth was possible. Fees of seven figures became fees of eight figures. "That's a bit far-fetched," Langhorne said slowly, her brain still burning with the math. "I'm not so sure," Hark said. It was obvious he knew more than the rest. "A waiver is a very simple document to execute. Are we expected to believe Mr. O'Reilly traveled to Brazil, found Rachel Lane, told her about Troy, got himself hired, but did not get a simple signature on a short document that would give the court jurisdiction? Something's going on here." Yancey was the first to say, "Brazil?" "Yes. He just returned from Brazil." "How do you know this?" Hark slowly reached into a file and removed some papers. "I have a very good investigator," he said, and the room was silent. "Yesterday, after I received her answer and O'Reilly's affidavit, same as you, I called the investigator. In 3 hours, he learned the following. On December 22nd, Nate O'Reilly left Dulles on Varig Flight 882 nonstop to Sao Paulo. From there, he flew Varig Flight 146 to Campo Grande, and then he took an Air Pantanal commuter to a small city called Caramba on the 23rd. He stayed almost 3 weeks, and then he returned to Dulles.
"Maybe it was a vacation," Bright mumbled.
He was as amazed as the rest of them.
"Maybe, but I doubt it. Mr. O'Reilly spent last fall in rehab, not for the first time. He was in the tank when Troy jumped. He was released on the 22nd, same day he left for Brazil. His trip had only one purpose, and that was to find Rachel Lane."
"How do you know all this?" Yancey had to ask.
"It's not that difficult, really, especially the flight information. Any good hacker can get it."
"How did you know he was in rehab?"
"Spies."
There was a long silence as they digested this. They simultaneously despised Hark and admired him. He seemed to always have information they didn't, yet he was on their side now. They were a team.
"It's just leverage," he said. "We go full speed ahead with discovery. We attack the will with a vengeance. We say nothing about the court's lack of jurisdiction over Rachel Lane. If she doesn't show either in person or by waiver, then it's an excellent indication that she doesn't want the money."
"I'll never believe that," Bright said.
"That's because you're a lawyer."
"What are you?"
"The same, just not as greedy. Believe it or not, Wally, there are people in this world who are not motivated by money."
"There are about 20 of them," Yancey said, "and they're all my clients." A little laughter broke the tension. Before adjourning, they once again forced each other to agree that everything they said was confidential. Each meant it, but no one completely trusted the other. The news about Brazil was especially delicate.
Chapter 43. The envelope was brown and slightly larger than legal-sized. Beside the World Tribes address in Houston were the words in bold black print, "For Rachel Lane, missionary in South America, personal and confidential." It was received by the mail clerk, examined for a few moments, then sent upstairs to a supervisor. Its journey continued throughout the morning until it landed, still unopened, on the desk of Neva Collier, coordinator of South American missions. She gaped at it in disbelief. No one knew Rachel Lane was a World Tribes missionary. No one but her. Evidently, those who'd passed it along did not make the connection between the name on the envelope and the name in the recent news. It was Monday morning. The offices were slow and quiet. Neva locked her door. Inside was a letter, addressed to whom it may concern, and a smaller, sealed envelope. She read the letter aloud, astounded by the fact that someone knew even the partial identity of Rachel Lane. "To whom it may concern. Enclosed is a letter to Rachel Lane, one of your missionaries in Brazil. Please forward it to her unopened. I met Rachel about 2 weeks ago. I found her in the Pantanal, living among the Ipicas, where, as you know, she has been for 11 years now. The purpose of my visit was a pending legal matter. For your information, she is doing well. I promised Rachel that I would not, under any circumstances, tell anyone of her location. She does not wish to be disturbed with any more legal matters, and I agreed to her request. She does need money for a new boat and motor, and also additional funds for medicines. I will gladly forward a check to your organization for these expenses. Just give me directions. I plan to write Rachel again, though I have no idea how she gets her mail. Could you please drop me a line and let me know this letter was received and that her letter was forwarded to her? Thanks." It was signed Nate O'Reilly. At the bottom of the letter was a phone number in St. Michael's, Maryland, and an address at a law firm in Washington. Corresponding with Rachel was a very simple matter. Twice a year, on March 1st and on August 1st, World Tribe sent packages to the post office in Corumbá.
Included were medical supplies, Christian literature, and anything else that she might need or want. The post office agreed to hold the August packages for 30 days, and if they went unclaimed, they were to be returned to Houston. This had never happened. In August of every year, Rachel made her annual trek to Corumbá, at which time she called the home office and practiced her English for 10 minutes. She collected her packages and returned to the Ipecas. In March, after the rainy season, the packages were sent upriver on a Shawana and dropped off at a fazenda near the mouth of the Sheco River. Laco would retrieve them eventually. The March packages were always smaller than the August ones. In 11 years, Rachel had never received a personal letter, at least not through World Tribes. Neva copied the phone number and address on a notepad, then hid the letter in a drawer. She would send it in a month or so, along with the usual supplies for March. They worked for almost an hour, cutting 2x4s for the next little classroom. The floor was covered with sawdust. Phil had some in his hair. The screech of the saw still rang in their ears. It was time for coffee. They sat on the floor, their backs to the wall, near a portable heater. Phil poured strong latte from a thermos. "You missed a great sermon yesterday," he said with a grin. "Where?" "What do you mean, where? Here, of course."
"What was the subject?"
"Adultery."
"For it or against it?"
"Against it, as always."
"I wouldn't think that'd be much of a problem with your congregation."
"I give the sermon once a year."
"Same sermon?"
"Yes, but always fresh."
"When was the last time one of your members had a problem with adultery?"
"Couple of years ago. One of our younger members thought her husband had another woman in Baltimore. He traveled there once a week on business, and she noticed that he returned home a different person. He had more energy, more enthusiasm for life. This would last for 2 or 3 days, then he was his usual cranky self again. She became convinced he had fallen in love."
Cut to the chase.
"He was seeing a chiropractor."
Phil laughed loudly through his nose, a strange cackle that was infectious and usually funnier than the punchline. When the humor passed, they sipped in unison. Then Phil asked, "In your other life, Nate, did you ever have a problem with adultery?"
"None whatsoever. It wasn't a problem, it was a way of life. I chased anything that walked. Every semi-attractive woman was nothing but a potential quickie. I was married, but I never thought that I was committing adultery. It wasn't sin, it was a game. I was a sick puppy, Phil."
"I shouldn't have asked."
"No, confession is good for the soul. I'm ashamed of the person I used to be. The women, booze, drugs, bars, fights, divorces, neglected children, I was a mess. I wish I had those days back. But it's important now to remember how far I've come."
"You have many good years left, Nate."
"I hope so. I'm just not sure what to do."
"Be patient. God will lead you."
"Of course, at the rate we're going, I could have a very long career right here."
Phil smiled, but didn't erupt with a cackle. "Study your Bible, Nate, and pray. God needs people like you."
"I suppose."
"Trust me. It took me 10 years to find God's will. I ran for a while, then I stopped and listened. Slowly he led me into the ministry."
"How old were you?"
"I was 36 when I entered the seminary."
"Were you the oldest one?"
"No. It's not uncommon to see people in their 40s in seminary. Happens all the time."
"How long does it take?"
4 years.
"That's worse than law school."
"It wasn't bad at all. In fact, it was quite enjoyable."
"Can't say that for law school."
They worked for another hour. Then it was time for lunch. The snow had finally melted, all of it, and there was a crab house down the road in Tillman that Phil enjoyed. Nate was anxious to buy lunch. "Nice car," Phil said as he belted himself in.
Sawdust shook from his shoulder onto the spotless leather seat of the Jaguar. Nate couldn't have cared less.
It's a lawyer's car. Leased, of course, because I couldn't afford to pay cash for it. $800 a month.
Sorry.
I'd love to unload it and get me a nice little Blazer or something.
Route 33 narrowed as they left town, and they were soon winding along the bay.
He was in bed when the phone rang, but not asleep. Sleep was an hour away. It was only 10, but his body was still accustomed to the routine of Walnut Hill, his trip south notwithstanding. And at times he felt some residual fatigue from the dengue. It was difficult to believe that for most of his professional life he often worked until 9 or 10 at night, then had dinner in a bar and drinks until 1. He grew weary just thinking about it. Since the phone seldom rang, he grabbed it quickly, certain it was trouble. A female voice said,
"Nate O'Reilly, please."
"This is Nate O'Reilly."
"Good evening, sir. My name is Neva Collier, and I received a letter from you for our friend in Brazil."
The covers flew off as Nate jumped from the bed.
"Yes, you got my letter?" "We did. I read it this morning, and I will send Rachel's letter to her."
"Wonderful. How does she get mail?"
"I send it to Corumbá at certain times of the year."
"Thank you. I'd like to write her again."
"That's fine, but please don't put her name on the envelopes."
It occurred to Nate that it was 9 o'clock in Houston. She was calling from home, and this seemed more than odd. The voice was pleasant enough, but tentative. "Is something wrong?" he asked.
"No, except that no one here knows who she is. No one but me. Now, with your involvement, there are 2 people in the world who know where she is and who she is."
"She swore me to secrecy."
"Was she difficult to find?"
"You could say that. I wouldn't worry about others finding her."
"But how did you do it?"
"Her father did it. You know about Troy Phelan?"
"Yes, I'm clipping news stories."
"Before he left this world, he tracked her to the Pantanal. I have no idea how he did it."
"He had the means."
"Yes, he did. We knew generally where she was, and I went down there, hired a guide, got lost, and found her. Do you know her well?"
"I'm not sure anyone knows Rachel well. I speak to her once a year in August from Corumbá. She tried a furlough 5 years ago, and I had lunch with her one day. But no, I don't know her that well."
"Have you heard from her recently?"
"No."
Rachel had been in Corumbá 2 weeks earlier. He knew this for a fact because she had come to the hospital. She had spoken to him, touched him, and then vanished along with his fevers. But she hadn't called the home office? How strange.
"She is doing well," he said, "very much at home with her people." "Why did you track her down?"
"Someone had to. Do you understand what her father did?"
"I'm trying to."
"Someone had to notify Rachel, and it had to be a lawyer. I just happen to be the only one in our firm with nothing better to do."
"And now you're representing her?"
"You are paying attention, aren't you?"
"We may have more than a passing interest. She is one of us, and she is, shall we say, out of the loop."
"That would be an understatement."
"What does she plan to do about her father's estate?"
Nate rubbed his eyes and paused to slow the conversation. A nice lady on the other end was stepping over the line. He doubted if she realized it. "I don't want to be rude, Ms. Collier, but I can't discuss with you things Rachel and I talked about pertaining to her father's estate."
"Of course not. I wasn't trying to pry. It's just that I'm not sure what World Tribe should do at this point."
"Nothing. You have no involvement unless Rachel asks you to step in."
"I see. So I'll just follow events in the newspapers."
"I'm sure the proceedings will be well documented."
"You mentioned certain things she needs down there."
Nate told her the story of the little girl who died because Rachel had no antivenin. "She can't find enough medical supplies in Corumbá. I'd love to send her whatever she needs."
"Thank you. Send the money to my attention at World Tribes, and I'll make sure she gets the supplies."
We have 4,000 Rachels around the world, and our budgets get stretched.
Are the others as remarkable as Rachel?
Yes. They are chosen by God.
They agreed to keep in touch. Nate could send all the letters he wanted. Neva would ship them to Korumba. If either one heard from Rachel, he or she would call the other. Back in bed, Nate replayed the phone call. The things that weren't said were amazing. Rachel had just learned from him that her father had died and left her one of the world's great fortunes. She then sneaked into Korumba because she knew from Lako that Nate was very ill. And then she left, without calling anyone at World Tribes to discuss the money. When he left her on the riverbank, he was convinced that she had no interest in the money. Now he was convinced even more. Chapter 44 The deposition derby began on Monday, February 17th, in a long, bare room in the Fairfax County Courthouse. It was a witness room, but Judge Wycliffe had pulled strings and reserved it for the last 2 weeks of the month. At least 15 people were scheduled to be deposed, and the lawyers had been unable to agree on places and times. Wycliffe had intervened. The depositions would be taken in an orderly fashion, one after the other, hour after hour, day after day, until finished. Such a marathon was rare, but then so were the stakes. The lawyers had shown an amazing ability to clear their calendars for the discovery phase of the Phelan matter. Trials had been postponed, other depositions wiggled out of, important deadlines delayed yet again, briefs shoved off on other partners, vacations happily put off until summer. Associates were sent to handle lesser chores. Nothing was as important as the Phelan mess. For Nate, the prospect of spending 2 weeks in a room crowded with lawyers, grilling witnesses, was a misery just short of hell itself. If his client didn't want the money, why should he care who got it? His attitude changed somewhat when he met the Phelan heirs. The first deponent was Mr. Troy Phelan, Jr. The court reporter swore him to honesty, but with his shifty eyes and reddened cheeks, he lost credibility within seconds of being seated at the head of the table. A video camera at the other end zoomed in on his face. Josh's staff had prepared hundreds of questions for Nate to hammer him with. The work and research had been done by a half-dozen associates, people Nate would never meet. But he could have handled it himself, off the cuff, with no preparation whatsoever. It was just a deposition, a fishing trip, and Nate had been there 1,000 times. Nate introduced himself to Troy Jr., who gave him a nervous smile, much like the inmate looking at the executioner. "This is not going to be painful, is it?" he seemed to ask. "Are you currently under the influence of any illegal drugs, prescription drugs, or alcohol?" Nate began pleasantly, and this rankled the Phelan lawyers on the other side of the table. Only Hark understood. He had taken almost as many depositions as Nate O'Reilly. The smile vanished. "I am not," Troy Jr. snapped. His head was pounding from a hangover, but he was currently sober. "And you understand that you have just sworn to tell the truth?"
"Yes."
"You understand what perjury is?"
"I certainly do."
"Which one is your lawyer?" Nate asked, waving at the crowd opposite.
"Hark Geddes."
The arrogance of Mr. O'Reilly rankled the attorneys again, this time Hark included. Nate hadn't bothered to learn which lawyers were attached to which client. His disdain for the entire group was offensive. Within the first 2 minutes, Nate had established a nasty tone for the day. There was little doubt that he distrusted Troy Jr. immensely, and perhaps the guy was under the influence. It was an old trick. "How many wives have you had?"
"How many have you had?" Junior shot back, then looked at his lawyer for approval.
Hark was studying a sheet of paper. Nate kept his cool. Who knew what the Phelan lawyers had been saying behind his back? He did not care. "Let me explain something to you, Mr. Phelan," Nate said, without the slightest irritation. "I will go over this very slowly, so listen carefully. I am the lawyer. You are the witness. Do you follow me so far? Troy Jr. slowly nodded. I ask the questions. You give the answers. Do you understand that? The witness nodded again. You don't ask questions, and I don't give answers. Understand?
Yep.
Now, I don't think you'll have trouble with the answers if you'll pay attention to the questions, okay? Junior nodded again. Are you still confused?
Nope.
Good. If you get confused again, please feel free to consult with your attorney. Am I getting through?
I understand.
Wonderful. Let's try it again. How many wives have you had?
Two.
An hour later, they finished with his marriages, his children, his divorce. Junior was sweating and wondering how long his deposition would last. The Phelan lawyers were staring blankly at sheets of paper and asking themselves the same thing. Nate, however, had yet to look at the pages of questions prepared for him. He could peel the skin off any witness simply by staring at his eyes and using one question to lead to another. No detail was too small for him to investigate. Where was your first wife's high school, college, first job? Was it her first marriage? Give us her employment history. Let's talk about the divorce. How much was your child support? Did you pay all of it? For the most part, it was useless testimony, evoked not for the sake of information, but rather to annoy the witness and put him on notice that the skeletons could be summoned from the closet. He filed the lawsuit. He had to suffer the scrutiny. His employment history took them to the brink of lunch. He stumbled badly when Nate grilled him about his various jobs for his father's companies. There were dozens of witnesses who could be called to rebut his version of how useful he'd been. With each job, Nate asked for the names of all his co-workers and supervisors. The trap was laid. Hark saw it coming and called time out. He stepped into the hall with his client and lectured him about telling the truth. The afternoon session was brutal. Nate asked about the $5 million he'd received on his 21st birthday, and the entire wall of Phelan lawyers seemed to stiffen.
That was a long time ago, Troy Jr. said, with an air of resignation. After 4 hours with Nate O'Reilly, he knew the next round would be painful.
Well, let's try to remember, Nate said with a smile. He showed no signs of fatigue. In fact, he'd been there so many times, he actually seemed anxious to grind through the details. His acting was superb. He hated being there and tormenting people he hoped he'd never see again. The more questions Nate asked, the more determined he was to start a new career.
How was the money given to you? He asked.
It was initially placed in an account in a bank.
You had access to the account?
Yes.
Did anyone else have access to the account?
No, just me.
How did you get money out of the account?
By writing checks.
And write them he did. His first purchase had been a brand new Maserati, dark blue. They talked about the damned car for 15 minutes. Troy Jr. never returned to college after receiving the money, not that any of the schools he'd attended were anxious to have him back. He simply partied. Though this came not in the form of a confession. Nate hammered him about his employment from ages 21 to 30 and slowly extricated enough facts to reveal that Troy Jr. did not work at all for those 9 years. He played golf and rugby, traded cars with gusto, spent a year in the Bahamas and a year in Vail, lived with an amazing assortment of women before finally marrying number one at the age of 29, and indulged himself in grand style until the money ran out. Then the prodigal son crawled to his father and asked for a job. As the afternoon wore on, Nate began to envision the havoc this witness would sow upon himself and those around him if he got his sticky fingers on the Phelan fortune. He would kill himself with the money. At 4 p.m., Troy Jr. asked to be excused for the day. Nate refused. During the break that followed, a note was sent to Judge Wycliffe down the hall. While they waited, Nate looked at Josh's questions for the first time. The return message instructed that the proceedings keep going. A week after Troy's suicide, Josh had hired a security firm to conduct an investigation into the Phelan heirs. The probe was more financial than personal. Nate skimmed the highlights while the witness smoked in the hall.
"What kind of car are you driving now?" Nate asked when they resumed. The exam took yet another direction.
"A Porsche."
"When did you buy it?"
"I've had it a while."
"Try to answer the question. When did you buy it?"
"A couple of months ago."
"Before or after your father's death?"
"I'm not real sure. Before, I think."
Nate lifted a sheet of paper. "What day did your father die?"
"Let me see.
It was a Monday. December the 9th, I think." "Did you buy the Porsche before or after December the 9th?"
"Like I said, I think it was before."
"Nope, wrong again. On Tuesday, December 10th, did you go to Irving Motors in Arlington and purchase a black 911 Porsche Carrera Turbo for $90,000, give or take?" Nate asked the question while reading from the sheet of paper. Troy Jr. squirmed and fidgeted yet again. He looked at Hark, who shrugged as if to say, "Answer the question, he's got the paperwork."
"Yes, I did."
"Did you buy any other cars that day?"
"Yes."
"How many?"
"A total of two."
"Two Porsches?"
"Yes. For a total of nearly $180,000, give or take."
"Something like that?" "How did you pay for them?"
"I haven't."
"So the cars were gifts from Irving Motors?"
"Not exactly. I bought them on credit."
"You qualified for credit?"
"Yes, at Irving Motors, anyway."
"Do they want their money?"
"Yes, you could say that."
Nate picked up more papers. "In fact, they've filed suit to recover either the money or the cars, haven't they?"
"Yes."
"Did you drive the Porsche to the deposition today?"
"Yes, it's in the parking lot."
"Let me get this straight. On December 10th, the day after your father died, you went to Irving Motors and bought two expensive cars on some type of credit. And now, 2 months later, you haven't paid a dime and are being sued, correct?" The witness nodded. "This is not the only lawsuit, is it?"
"No,"
Troy Jr. said in defeat. Nate almost felt sorry for him. A rental company was suing for non-payment on a furniture lease. American Express wanted over $15,000. A bank sued Troy Jr. a week after the reading of his father's will. Jr. had fast-talked it into a loan of $25,000, secured by nothing but his name. Nate had copies of all the litigation, and they trudged through the details of each lawsuit. At 5, another argument occurred. Another note was sent to Wycliffe. The judge appeared himself and asked about their progress. "When do you think you'll finish with this witness?" he asked Nate.
"There's no end in sight," Nate said, staring at Junior, who was in a trance and praying for liquor.
"Then work until 6, Wycliffe said. "Can we start at 8 in the morning?" Nate asked, as if they were going to the beach.
8:30, His Honor decreed, then left.
For the last hour, Nate peppered Junior with random questions on many subjects. The deponent had no clue where his interrogator was going, and Junior was being led by a master. Just as they settled on one topic and he began to feel comfortable, Nate changed course and hit him with something new. "How much money did he spend from December 9th to December 27th, the day the will was read? What did he buy his wife for Christmas, and how did he pay for the gifts? What did he buy for his children? Back to the $5 million, did he put any of the money in stocks or bonds? How much money did Biff earn last year? Why did her first husband get custody of her kids? How many lawyers had he hired and fired since his father died? And on and on." At precisely 6, Hark stood and announced the deposition was being adjourned. 10 minutes later, Troy Jr. was in a bar in a hotel lobby 2 miles away. Nate slept in the Stafford guest room. Mrs. Stafford was somewhere in the house, but he never saw her. Josh was in New York on business. The second day of questioning started on time. The cast was the same, though the lawyers were dressed much more casually. Junior wore a red cotton sweater. Nate recognized the face of a drunk, the red eyes, the puffy flesh around them, the pink cheeks and nose, the sweat above the brows. The face had been his for years. Treating the hangover was as much a part of the morning as the shower and the dental floss. Take some pills, drink lots of water, and strong coffee. If you're going to be stupid, you got to be tough. You realize that you're still under oath, Mr. Phelan? He began.
I do.
Are you under the influence of any drugs or alcohol?
No, sir, I am not.
Good. Let's go back to December the 9th, the day your father died. Where were you when he was examined by the three psychiatrists?
I was in his building in a conference room with my family.
And you watched the entire examination, didn't you?
I did.
There were two color monitors in the room, right? Each 26 inches wide?
If you say so, I didn't measure them.
But you could certainly see them, couldn't you?
Yes.
Your view was unobstructed.
I had a clear view, yes.
And you had a clear reason to watch your father closely?
I did.
Did you have any trouble hearing him?
No.
The lawyers knew where Nate was going. It was an unpleasant aspect of their case, but one that could not be avoided. Each of the six heirs would be led down this path. So you watched and heard the entire exam?
I did.
You missed nothing?
I missed nothing.
Of the three psychiatrists, Dr. Zeidel had been hired by your family, correct?
That's correct.
Who found him?
The lawyers.
You trusted your lawyers to hire the psychiatrist?
Yes.
For 10 minutes, Nate quizzed him on exactly how they came to select Dr. Zeidel for such a crucial exam, and in the process got what he wanted. Zeidel was hired because he had excellent credentials, came highly recommended, and was very experienced. Were you pleased with the way he handled the exam? Nate asked.
I suppose.
Was there something you didn't like about Dr. Zeidel's performance?
Not that I recall.
The trip to the edge of the cliff continued, as Troy Jr. admitted that he was pleased with the exam, pleased with Zeidel, happy with the conclusions reached by all three doctors, and left the building with no doubt that his father knew what he was doing. After the exam, when did you first doubt your father's mental stability? Nate asked.
When he jumped.
On December the 9th.
Right.
So you had doubts immediately?
Yes.
What did Dr. Zeidel say to you when you expressed these doubts?
I didn't talk to Dr. Zeidel.
You didn't?
No.
From December 9th to December 27th, the day the will was read in court, how many times did you talk to Dr. Zeidel?
I don't remember any.
Did you see him at all?
No.
Did you call his office?
No.
Have you seen him since December the 9th?
No.
Having walked him to the edge, it was time for the shove. Why did you fire Dr. Zeidel? Junior had been prepped to some degree.
You'll have to ask my lawyer that,
he said, and hoped Nate would just go away for a while. I'm not deposing your lawyer, Mr. Phelan. I'm asking you why Dr. Zeidel was fired.
You'll have to ask the lawyers. It's part of our legal strategy.
Did the lawyers discuss it with you before Dr. Zeidel was fired?
I'm not sure. I really can't remember.
Are you pleased that Dr. Zeidel no longer works for you?
Of course I am.
Why?
Because he was wrong. Look, my father was a master con man, okay? He bluffed his way through the exam same way he did all of his life, then jumped out of the window. He snowed Zeidel and the other shrinks. They fell for his act. He was obviously off his rocker.
Because he jumped?
Yes, because he jumped. Because he gave his money to some unknown heir. Because he made no effort to shield his fortune from estate taxes. Because he'd been crazy as hell for some time. Why do you think we had the exam to begin with? If he hadn't been nuts, would we have needed three shrinks to check him out before he signed his will?
But the three shrinks said he was okay.
Yeah, and they were dead wrong. He jumped. Sane people don't fly out of windows.
What if your father had signed the thick will and not the handwritten one, and then he jumped? Would he be crazy?
We wouldn't be here.
It was the only time during the 2-day ordeal that Troy Jr. fought to a draw. Nate knew to move on, then to come back later. Let's talk about Rooster Inns, he announced, and Junior's shoulders fell 3 inches. It was just another one of his bankrupt ventures, nothing more or less, but Nate had to have every little detail. One bankruptcy led to another. Each failure prompted questions about other doomed enterprises. Junior's had been a sad life. Though it was hard to be sympathetic, Nate realized that the poor guy had never had a father. He had longed for Troy's approval and never received it. Josh told him that Troy had taken great delight when his children's ventures collapsed. The lawyer freed the witness at 5:30, day two. Rex was next. He'd waited in the hall throughout the day and was highly agitated at being put off again. Josh had returned from New York. Nate joined him for an early dinner. Chapter 45. Rex Phelan had spent most of the previous day on the cell phone in the hallway while his brother was roughed up by Nate O'Reilly. Rex had been in enough lawsuits to know that litigation meant waiting. Waiting for lawyers, judges, witnesses, experts, trial dates, and appeals courts, waiting in hallways for your turn to give testimony. When he raised his right hand and swore to tell the truth, he already despised Nate. Both Hark and Troy Jr. had warned him of what was to come. The lawyer could get under your skin and fester there like a boil. Again, Nate started with inflammatory questions, and within 10 minutes the room was tense. For 3 years, Rex had been the target of an FBI investigation. A bank had failed in 1990. Rex had been an investor and director. Depositors lost money, borrowers lost their loans, litigation had been raging for years with no end in sight. The president of the bank was in jail, and those close to the epicenter thought Rex would be next. There was enough dirt to keep Nate going for hours. For fun, he continually reminded Rex that he was under oath. There was also a very good chance the FBI would see his deposition. It was mid-afternoon before Nate worked his way to the strip bars. Rex owned 6 of them, held in his wife's name in the Fort Lauderdale area. He'd bought them from a man killed in a gunfight. They were simply irresistible as subjects of conversation. Nate took them one by one. Lady Luck, Lolita's, Club Tiffany, etc., and asked 100 questions. He asked about the girls, the strippers, where they came from, how much they earned, did they use drugs, what drugs, did they touch the customers, and on and on. He asked question after question about the economics of the skin business. After 3 hours of carefully painting a portrait of the sleaziest business in the world, Nate asked, "Didn't your current wife work in one of the clubs?" The answer was yes, but Rex couldn't just blurt it out. His throat and neck flashed red, and for a moment he appeared ready to lunge across the table. "She was a bookkeeper," he said with a clenched jaw. "She ever do any dancing on the tables?" Another pause as Rex squeezed the table with his fingers. "She certainly did not." It was a lie, and everyone in the room knew it. Nate flipped through some papers, searching for the truth. They watched him carefully, half expecting him to pull out a photo of Amber in a G-string and kinky heels. They adjourned at 6 again, with the promise of more tomorrow. When the video camera was off and the court reporter was busy putting away her equipment, Rex stopped at the door, pointed at Nate, and said, "No more questions about my wife, okay?" "That's impossible, Rex. All assets are in her name." Nate waved some papers at him as if he had all their records. Hark shoved his client through the door. Nate sat alone for an hour, skimming notes, flipping pages, wishing he were in St. Michael's, sitting on the porch of the cottage with a view of the bay. He needed to call Phil. "This is your last case," he kept telling himself, "and you're doing it for Rachel." By noon of the second day, the Phelan lawyers were openly discussing whether Rex's deposition would take 3 days or 4. He had over $7 million in liens and judgments filed against him, yet the creditors couldn't execute because all assets were in the name of his wife, Amber, the ex-stripper. Nate took each judgment, laid it on the table, examined it from every conceivable angle and direction, then placed it back in the file, where it might stay and it might not. The tedium was unnerving everyone but Nate, who somehow kept an earnest demeanor as he plodded ahead. For the afternoon session, he selected the topic of Troy's leap and the events leading up to it. He followed the same line he'd used on Junior, and it was obvious Hark had prepped Rex. His answers to the questions about Dr. Zadel were rehearsed but adequate. Rex hung with the party line. The three psychiatrists were simply wrong because Troy jumped minutes later. More familiar territory was covered when Nate grilled him about his dismal employment career with the Phalen Group. Then they spent two painful hours wasting the $5 million Rex had received as his inheritance. At 5:30, Nate abruptly said he was finished and walked out of the room. Two witnesses in 4 days. Two men laid bare on video, and it wasn't a pretty sight. The Phalen lawyers went to their separate cars and drove away. Perhaps the worst was behind them, perhaps not. Their clients had been spoiled as children, ignored by their father, cast into the world with fat checking accounts at an age when they were ill-equipped to handle money and expected to prosper. They had made bad choices, but all blame ultimately went back to Troy. That was the considered judgment of the Phalen lawyers. Libigail was led in early Friday morning and placed in the seat of honor. Her hair was of a style quite similar to a crew cut, with the sides peeled to the skin and an inch of gray on top. Cheap jewelry hung from her neck and wrists, so that when she raised her hand to be sworn, there was a racket at her elbow. She looked at Nate in horror. Her brothers had told her the worst. But it was Friday, and Nate wanted out of the city more than he wanted food when he was hungry. He smiled at her and began with easy background questions. Kids, jobs, marriages. For 30 minutes, all was pleasant. Then he began to probe into her past. At one point he asked, "How many times have you been through rehab for drugs and alcohol?" The question shocked her, so Nate said, "I've done it 4 times myself, so don't be ashamed." His candor disarmed her. "I really can't remember,"